Well, hello everybody, and the hour is later now, but it looks like I'm hopefully wide enough awake to do a program here. We're on video commentary number 38 for the Rules for Magic on the Astral Plane, and this is page 360, we've just been through a difficult section, and unfortunately I rushed. You know, I said that the rules of the road were in this book, but they're not. They're in the Glamour book, and I think in the Discipleship book. And I promised you a short program, half hour, before we got to the rules of the road. Well, I conducted that and did that tonight. It took longer than a half hour. And we finally, in the Dissipation of Glamour group, got to the rules of the road. Okay. But anyway, this last section has a lot of obscure facts in it, abstruse facts. And yes, it is a half hour in length. It deals with the adepts and what they're working on, the Aryan adepts' attempt to impress upon the world consciousness that God is will. It all goes, you know, sort of sequentially, Saturnian in manner, not all at once, we might say. And the Atlantean adepts, well, let's see, is it here? They work to impress upon the world that that God is love. Well, somewhere here. We find it. Okay, here it is. And I'll make that also a larger, impressible thought. Because after all, you know, we do want to have certain things in mind. He gives us the idea that we can trace from our astral body or from our mental body, we can extend or we can progress the type of energy that we find there, and we can do it in such a way that it leads us to higher realizations. Let's see if I can find that one as well. Progressed. In using these words, I refer primarily to the life which is expressing itself through our planet or to our planetary logos, but the idea can, needless to say, be progressed. And we can take it much higher. We have a mention of the head, heart, and throat center, and it's interesting that he has connected them, the head center with humanity and the brain, and the heart center with the animal kingdom, and the throat center, in this case, with the vegetable kingdom. So some of the correspondences that we find in this section of the book are a little bit obscure. Okay. And he also talks about the mineral kingdom as being related to the solar plexus. I guess he's simply descending there, if I have that right. And he deals with some of the involutionary kingdoms as well, relating them to the lower centers. The three kingdoms on the involutionary arc, and what are they? Let's see, they are comprised of different degrees, densities, comprised of different densities of elemental essence. They correspond to the three lower centers. And the mineral kingdom, as abstruse as the idea may seem, to those of you who have not yet the consciousness of the life aspect, I'm afraid that includes us all, corresponding to the solar plexus center. Yeah. Well, okay. We have to take his word for it here, and then we'll try to work it out as we go along. So he's in a section of the book where he is dealing with analogies. Man can be brought into line with the esoteric head center of the one life. And then he starts referring to nature. You know, not only the one life, but to nature. So Let's see where that comes in. The animal kingdom, through the development of sentiency and its allied involvement through pain, they bring those types of forms into line with the heart center in nature. Now, this is not necessarily the life of the planetary logos, but when I see a term like nature, I immediately think, goodness, are we talking about the, particularly about the natural world? And we might think of that as the 18 lower subplanes, perhaps. I don't think the word nature is accidental. So, you know, we have a kind of an obscure beginning here, and it's difficult to determine all the meanings, but let's just say a few things do come out. The Aryan adepts impress will. The Atlantean adepts impress the idea that God is love. The human kingdom is related to the esoteric planetary head center, presumably that Shambhala. The animal kingdom, let's see here, is related to the planetary heart or to the heart center, and the vegetable kingdom to the throat center. So, and we have to see whether we're talking about the planetary head center and the planetary heart center and the planetary throat center. So the esoteric head center, man is therefore brought into line with the esoteric center of the one life. Well, that's got to be Shambhala, I think. I think so. You know, I'm kind of reviewing this because I rushed through it before and thought I could grab a half hour there and do that, but instead I confounded things, I'm afraid. So this is in all probability Shambhala. Okay, in the animal kingdom, through the development of sentiency and its allied unfoldment through pain, and notice, sentiency unfolds through pain. This is something we have to remember. So if we want to be more sensitive, I'm afraid we're going to have to experience pain as a sensitizer. Goodness. All right. They are, let's see, in the animal kingdom, the development of sentiency and its allied unfoldment through pain. They are bringing those types of forms into line with the heart center in nature. Now, he doesn't say within the one life. He says the heart center in nature, and I cannot think that that word is accidental. And when I think of the natural world, I think of the, at least I think of the dense visible body of the planetary logos of the lower 18 subplanes. This is a phrase conveying a truth which cannot be more clearly expressed until man has become more inclusive in his consciousness. So he hints that the word nature holds a riddle for us, or perhaps an unsolved problem. And through color in the vegetable kingdom, those forms of divine manifestation are also brought into vibratory contact with the center of force in nature, which is analogous to the throat center in man. So he's not saying in the planetary life. Once again, even if we can't solve it, at least we can be aware that it is something to be solved. Now, that is a point, isn't it? I mean, you know, we may read lightly over something and not realize that something is there, which really is obscure and difficult to understand. But if we can identify something as difficult to understand, we have a better chance of applying ourselves to it. So there's nature and supernature, and for me, nature is the lower 18 subplanes. And with regard to our planet, supernature begins with the higher mental plane and on beyond that. So, you know, there's the world of the human development and the world of the superhuman, and maybe the natural world is largely the world of human development. It is mostly in the 18 lower subplanes, but there is that ongoing Temple of Solomon, a beautification and expansion taking place on the higher mental plane. So I'm not sure what he means here by nature, but I have maybe an educated guess. And I also talked about the idea of combining kingdoms of nature. so that maybe the lower three kingdoms of nature, the animal, plant, and mineral, have some kind of entity which supervises the three entities which rule them. And maybe, I don't know, there are a number of kingdoms, you know, solar kingdom, planetary lives, kingdom of souls. Can they be combined, and can some entities superior to the entities that rule an individual kingdom rule a combination? That is simply speculation. Can there be an entity that rules all the seven kingdoms of nature that he lists for us? This has to do with the structure of hierarchicalization. In other words, let's say we're looking at the egoic lotus, and let's say that there is some sort of minor solar angel or Petri that rules each one of the petals. But then we know that of a particular tier or circle, but then we know that there is a type of entity which rules all the three petals in a particular tier. So there are lesser Petris ruling the petals, and greater Petris ruling the combination of petals. Now we can take that further and say that there are Petris of a fairly advanced sort that rule all three petals in a single tier. Let's say there are three of them: the novice petals, the love petals, and the sacrifice petals. Maybe there is an entity which rules all nine, a solar entity, a Petri of some kind, which rules all nine of the usual petals. And maybe, well, it's quite possible, you know, that each one of the synthesis petals is ruled by a Petri, but then all three together by a greater Petri, and then maybe all 12 somehow ruled by a still greater Petri. Probably the solar angel in some way rules all of it, you know. The egoic lotus is interesting because it's a combination of that which the monad projects into the higher mental plane. And I think we can see that, you know, here in Tuya's new renderings. Let's see, maybe I'll go over here. One, two, three. There it is. Here the monad is projecting straight into the center of the higher mental plane, and so there is definitely monadic representation, but at the same time, the solar angel here on the Buddhic plane is projecting into the higher mental plane as well, its own type of I-ness consciousness. And so there's a blending of consciousnesses, and that whole idea about a yoga of the blending of consciousnesses, I think, is very real. And so you have two types, perhaps, of consciousness. And when does the solar angel embrace the entirety of the egoic lotus, or does its projection into the higher mental plane, which I call, at least for the time being, until my ignorance is straightened out, I call it the angel of the presence. And does that projection embrace the entirety of the egoic lotus? Okay, and so maybe that would be a much greater solar Petri than the minor ones that in group formation, and probably as emanations of the greater ones, rule the individual petals, rule the individual tiers or circles. You know, so what we have is a hierarchy of solar Petris in any one demonstration of that group form, which we call an egoic lotus. And, you know, it's the same way down in the personality of man. We have the mental elemental, astral elemental, physical elemental, and the three of them together combine to make a still greater elemental we call the personality elemental. So it's the question of how we combine the lesser in order to make the greater, how that process of combining really works. We don't know yet, but if we can identify that it does occur, then, okay, that's a place to do some research. Okay, so anyway, what I tried to do is make up for my sins, which were caused by rushing, you know, trying to grab a half hour here where I could do some work and getting a little confused and including glamour in this book, which I shouldn't have done. I mean, the book Glamour, A World Problem. And then at least trying to point out some of the major points that D.K. made, including, as I say, some very abstruse references, even to Three Kingdoms on the Evolutionary Arc and the correspondence of these various kingdoms in nature, man, animal, vegetable, mineral, and three evolutionary kingdoms to the chakras within man and to the chakras within the planet, perhaps. Now, when we're dealing with kingdoms, kingdom is a very big thing. The kingdom of humanity, human kingdom, exists on all the planets. And I don't know what we can say about, you know, certainly it looks like the mineral kingdom does. And if we have animal and plant forms, probably while these planets are in obscuration, we don't have an outer demonstration of these kingdoms. But my guess is that kingdoms are system-wide, if I can say. And when we talk about the human kingdom and the animal kingdom, the vegetable kingdom, we're not just talking about our own particular planet, but in different ways and through different forms, we have kingdoms on the other planets as well, all in different states of development and obscuration and manifestation and all those things being probably, you know, secrets which are revealed as we know, as we learn more and more. Well, you know, here it is, an early book, A Treatise on White Magic, and we imagine perhaps that it should be simple, but it's not simple. Not at all. And we can learn a tremendous amount about general occultism from this particular book. It can be read on very many levels, and it's a good foundation for the future of the white magician when he will be given certain missing keys to the magical process. And those keys can be based upon the academic learning, or they can be facilitated. Their use can be facilitated by the academic learning, which we are going through right now. So don't shun the academics. They may not seem to live, but they make a great scaffolding, a great foundation for the more living processes in the work which we will be engaged in later. We have to think the long term, you know, the footsteps of the masters, it said they stride centuries, you know, maybe one step is a century. And for us, we're, you know, lucky to stride days or weeks or month, whatever. We have a long way to go. But the path, which we are, has been laid out for us clearly by master teachers, and one of the most proficient and sanctioned by the hierarchy is Master D.K. Okay, well, that was a bit of a catch-up, and so, you know, excuse me, fools rush in where angels fear to tread. You know, I've always thought the sign Aries, which is my sun sign, is the sign of the fool. It's not technically in the tarot the sign of the fool, but certainly in terms of rushing in where angels fear to tread, it has that reputation to which I can attest. All right, so now we are dealing with certain analogies, and according to the law of mutation, these analogies change as time progresses. So it makes a very complex picture of triangles in rotation and different points of emphasis of two or three related factors. Okay, these analogies change as time progresses. In the Lemurian days, viewing it as a kingdom in nature, humanity expressed, the solar plexus aspect. Whilst the animal kingdom stood for the sacral center, and the center of the base of the spine was symbolized by the vegetable kingdom. I knew I had read that. I mentioned it a little bit meekly earlier on in a previous program. I said, well, I seem to remember DK speaking of humanity as a solar plexus center. But then I didn't realize how time related that was, or at least I had forgotten that factor. So in Lemurian days, and that's old times, you know, the individualization 18 and a half, well, 21 million years ago, but sort of coming into the realization maybe 18 and a half million years ago, a long time, and then we had early Atlantean times, and there was some kind of overlap 12 million years ago, DK tells us. So, you know, it's a long time ago. In the Lemurian days, viewing it as a kingdom in nature, humanity expressed the solar plexus aspect. Why? Well, you know, let's just say there was certainly no thinking as we think of thinking now. The mind was not very developed at all, and even in the Lemurian days, the solar plexus or desire aspect had to be developed as man was emerging from the strictly instinctual physical stage. We can understand that the animal kingdom ruled by Mars would relate to the sacral center, also ruled by Mars, just as the physical body, which the sacral center produces, is ruled by Mars. And the center of the base of the spine was symbolized by the vegetable kingdom. And, whew, you know, how do we visualize that? What can we see? What can we think about the condition of those three kingdoms in those early days? Probably, you know, the flora and the fauna was, I think, you know, quite different. I mean, if we even have mastodons walking around not long ago, we can imagine that there were lots of, let's say, even mammals that were very different from the mammals that we have now. I've always wondered, you know, whether the implication that Blavatsky seems to give, that man, some kind of man, was present in the era of the dinosaurs. Am I misunderstanding that? I don't know. It seems that that's the implication. I'm wondering to what extent that can be true, and whether the geology of the planet and the study of the various evolutionary tracks will reveal that it is true. If it is, it's very different from what we now propose. You know, millions of years ago, Lemuria did exist, or at least early unindividualized man did exist, and maybe the midway point in the Lemurian period could have been like 18 million years ago, meaning maybe it went back 30 million years. Well, when we start to talk about 30 million years, it may not be the what we call the Jurassic period, but it's definitely a period in which some vestigial dinosaurs could have existed, and very strange animals indeed. And then even before that, we had these powerful races of proto-men, pre-Lemurian. Maybe they were etheric to a certain extent. I'm not sure how much density was there. But if we take it back far enough, we could enter into a period which we are calling, you know, Jurassic or Triassic, or many millions of years ago. I don't know if we're going back to the time of the trilobites, which is estimated to be like 400 million years ago. Maybe not. But Master Kuhumi suggests that a lot of judgments about evolution and geology will have to be re-evaluated in light of that which the secret doctrine and the ageless wisdom will reveal. As usual, there will be discomfort for the people who have been holding tight to a very concrete theory. In the middle of the Atlantean period, is that like 4.4 or 4.5, you know, using the terminology which Phil Lindsay uses, and I certainly would recommend whoever can to read The Hidden History of Humanity, and I believe he and Justin Wilkinson have created some videos which have a very good audience now on YouTube. So, you know, go in there and see what is Philip's estimation of these. I consider him an excellent historian regarding humanity and the kingdoms of nature and the general planetary development. So, you know, let's avail ourselves of what is available. In the middle of the Atlantean period, when certain great changes and experiments were wrought, you know, and even, I want to say, even a shift towards initiation as a possibility, maybe was that in 4.4 or was that 4.5? I guess the question there arises, was the Great War, Atlantean War, which we can pretty well think of as having occurred in 4.4, 4 being such a warring ray, it was said that men were approaching the light at that time. Were they approaching the light of initiation, which seems to be a 4.5 kind of thing? Anyway, when they approached the light, the dark forces that wanted to hold them back went to war, and they fought for their original previous chain, moon chain, and solar previous solar system prerogatives, you know, hanging on to their prison, we might say. So great changes and experiments were wrought. A shift in the entire process took place, and certain egos came in, as you know, as related in The Secret Doctrine and in A Treatise on Cosmic Fire, and a tremendous stepping forward became possible through their efforts. Now, this is moonchain humanity coming in 4.3. And I think the Buddha was among them, a highly developed moonchain type who had not taken the third initiation on the moonchain, says the Tibetan, but in fact did take it with the Christ in Atlantean days. I suppose Middle Atlantean days. I don't know if he refers to 4.3 as the middle of the Atlantean period. Well, it's certainly early middle. Anyway, the cheetah or mind stuff became more vibrant, and I might say, because of the number 3 and the numerical affinity of 3 with cheetah. And now we have the period of intensest, of its intensest activity in the concrete sense, and this is the development of the cheetah in the very concrete Aryan age. So not only are we principally found in the fifth or Aryan root race, but until further developments, we are focused on the fifth sub-race, the Teutonic, of the Aryan root race. So 5.5, and with 5.6 now coming into possible development with the development of the abstract mind. I think a lot of us who study the Tibetan and think in the way, try to think in the way that he is proposing we think, are entering, at least in our consciousness, the 5.6 stage. All right. You know, the Tibetan has a wonderful teacher, a very intricate mind, or a mind able to detect intricacy. And sometimes he actually dares to present it to us, and hopefully we don't become too bewildered. Sometimes he says, look, this is just too intricate, and I'm not going to get into it right now, because he knows maybe the kind of mess we could make of it trying to interpret it. But he's some kind of blend to me of the second ray and the third ray, with some first ray, as he says, on the triad level. And well, that's kind of the rays of the earth, isn't it? Well, anyway, he is able to get into the profundities of the teaching, the intricacies of the teaching, and the major principles of the teaching. I think he's on the third subcategory of the second ray. It's not exactly the pure wisdom type. It's the type of detailed unity and what I would call, or he called, meticulous entirety. We are told, he says, in the esoteric teaching, that all three aspects of divinity are themselves triple, you know, so making the number 9, which is the cyclic number of the third ray. And hence we can divide the energy of mind, as far as humanity is concerned, into three aspects also. And I wonder if we could do this with love and do this with will. I mean, you know, it seems that we could, you know. There is the suggestion that we can do this triple division with both love and will, as well as intelligence, as well as mind. Let's just call it mind. Okay. All right. So number one, the lower concrete mind called the citta or mind stuff in the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali. Now, all of these areas of mind are on the cosmic physical plane. They're material, and they have their own types of atoms of diminishing complexity as we rise through the planes. So simplicity is found on the higher levels and complexity on the lower. So the lower concrete mind, that's number one, an area of mind. The abstract mind, or that aspect of the mind which is related to the world of ideas, but not producing the ideas so much as clothing them in understandable mental substance. Okay, substance. Oh, I bet it's two B's. Yep. Okay. And then the intuition of pure reason, which is for man the highest aspect of mentality, DK, relating this to Mercury, I believe, DK relating this to Mercury has called this transcendental mind. Now, the problem there is we, you know, it seems, oh, the disc is full. Okay. But not really, not really. Hopefully, let's just see if they've given me, if I, you know, you always want to see whether you're really, really saving or not saving. And if you're not saving, then you have a problem. 2349, it looks like we saved. Okay. So, even without going onto the Buddhic plane to find pure reason, we could find a triplicity of mind with the lower concrete mind, the sun of mind, indicating the subplane number 2 and 3, and the abstract mind subplane number 1. But he divides it this way, and in a way, they're all ruled by different capacities of Mercury. Mercury has a great flexibility and a great range, and it can move all the way from the most concrete to the most abstract. So anyway, we have, therefore, at least in the triplicity of mind, these three. Now, I suppose we could get into what might be the triplicity of love and the triplicity of will. Sometimes I think about the different wills, you know, the will to be, the will to good, the will to manifest. He deals with three types of will in esoteric astrology, related to three first ray signs: Aries, Leo, and Capricorn. And he goes from the will to create with Aries to the will to fulfillment of Leo, and then the will which conquers death, obviously, of a first ray application of the will when we deal with Capricorn. You know, intricacy, that's all I can say. It's difficult. We get caught in the forest, in the trees. We don't see the forest, but eventually we see the forest and we don't get lost like a good guide. And, you know, a good guide has to know the terrain and have been there many times and almost instinctually take the right path under any types of circumstances. And DK is that. Okay, these three find their overshadowing or enveloping field of expression in the third aspect of the logos, which we call the universal mind, the active intelligent deity. Let us say that for practical purposes. This is found on the cosmic mental plane, on whichever level, I don't know. But the universal mind, or what we can call the universal mind, has expressions on the cosmic astral plane and the cosmic physical plane. But it's that cosmic mental plane which contains something which we might call the mind of our planetary logos or the mind of our solar logos. There are expressions, as I say, on the cosmic physical plane and even on the cosmic astral plane. But the real source of the mentality of those great beings is on the cosmic mental plane. The lines of force from these three lower aspects lead back, up, back up. let's take a look here. Or up, or on a line of, I call it emanative retraction, if one may use so inadequate expression as back, onto the third plane, as the astral lines of force lead back to the second or monadic plane. Well, the third plane would be the atomic plane, and it is an aspect of universal mind as expressed on the cosmic physical plane. So, the atomic plane, as the astral lines of force lead back to the second or monadic plane, here we have a reversal. You know, it's not so much a correspondence that you can stack one on the other, it's a reflection. So, tying the 6 and 2 of the astral to the 2 and 6 of the monadic plane, though as far as man's consciousness is concerned, they only lead back to the Buddhic or intuitional plane, yet the monadic plane is along the same line as the Buddhic plane and the cosmic astral plane. So we just have to understand these lines of progression, and everything is connected. You know, I mean, there really are no breaks, no real breaks. Even under the Antikarana, the life thread is existing. There's an apparent break in consciousness because development hasn't gone far enough. But the solar angel came in, and with its projection, filled that gap. And then, of course, we have to refill it on our own and cannot forever rely upon having a causal body or an egoic lotus, as they say. All right. Cosmic astral plane. Tap. Here we go. Sometimes those little abbreviations do help. It is interesting to note that just as the monad, impelled by desire, of a much higher kind than ordinary desire, produces that form of life which we call the personality. Now, note this. The solar angel is not the only producer of personality. It's a combination of efforts. So the mind aspect on the part of the purpose working out through the universal mind in its form produces that manifestation which we call a Manasaputra, the great son of mind on the mental plane. And this means the solar angel and its, I still insist on this until proven incorrectly, its projection called the Angel of the Presence. Angel of the Presence. Okay, so we're looking at desire, having produced the personality, the desire of the monad, and the mind aspect as part of the purpose working out through the universal mind, much higher, maybe the lowest aspect of universal mind from, well, an exalted point of view, is the atomic plane. So the mind aspect in its form produces that manifestation which we call the Manasaputra. The solar angel is a blend of the second and fifth rays. It carries the love wisdom aspect, a heart of fiery love, but it's also working on the fifth plane, but it's working from the Buddhic plane, and its projection into the mental plane is what I call the angel of the presence until proven incorrect. All you can do is offer speculations and then stay alert, stay attentive, and see if those speculations bear out either factually or according to the law of correspondences. Hence, it is the mind principle in humanity which brings into incarnation the egoic body, the causal vehicle, the Karana Sarira, the 12-petaled lotus. Notice here he calls it the 12-petaled lotus, and elsewhere he calls it the 9-petaled lotus. It's just a question of whether those inner petals are unfolded or not, the synthesis petals, right? So that's interesting. The mind principle, as it is stimulated, we might say, maybe this is true, you know, possibly, the mental unit in its development at a certain point of development attracts the possibility of linking up with a solar angel. Now, you know, we did have egoic lotuses without solar angels on the moon chain and in the previous solar system. The solar angel is like a bridge over troubled waters, as they say, or a bridge over a gap, over a chasm. The chasm existed, and there was no way to bridge that chasm except over a very, very long period of time, which due to the moon chain failure would have delayed the time-space schedule of the planetary logos. So, you know, we all have to kind of look after each other, and where someone is lagging, you help them ahead, and we've been helped on. Our Earth should be at the same level of development as Venus, but it wasn't because some poor choices, apparently, cosmically considered, were made by our planetary logos. It's still possible under the, must be a universal law of freedom, to choose incorrectly, even as a great being. So, you know, there's not absolutely infinite omniscience. There's an unveiling, and as long as there's a self-veiling, we cannot see our choices, and even the great beings are self-veiled compared to the universal logos, which is infinitely veiled compared to the absolute deity and the absoluteness, which is the ultimate state, in my view. Okay, so anyway, it's the mind which seems to call the egoic body or the causal vehicle into manifestation. We might call it the rising of the mental unit. It happens along, I did some research on the mental unit, and it really is developing even somehow in the animal stage and over a long period of time. It's not like something that just suddenly appears. It's developmental. We are, of course, talking entirely in terms of the form aspect here. So, lower mind, calls in developments, on the plane of higher mind. And the reason for this lies back on the cosmic planes, where on the planetary logos has his life, his egoic, EGB. Okay, so if I EGB it here, EGB, we could call it egoic body, or egoic lotus, doesn't make any difference. His egoic body is found on the third subplane of the cosmic mental plane. From the cosmic astral plane comes the impulse, which produces form existence, just as, you know, when we think about the form of a human being, the impulse comes from the astral plane, and concrete expression for all form taking is the result of desire. This is the big statement. So there would be no form if not for the desire's impulse from the astral plane. He tells us also that some ancient fears and desires lurk in the sacral center, and that center, of course, being the one that is responsible in part for producing the dense physical vehicle. But I guess there has to be an impulse of desire to get the sacral center going to do its more tangible work. From the cosmic mental plane comes the will to be in time and space, which produces the seven groups of egoic love, egoic lives, and the third outpouring, which relates to the monad. Well, this gets into some pretty, you know, heavy theosophy here, but I think we have a chart which shows us the different outpourings. Let's see if we can just find that, you know, back here. Okay. Outpourings. Anyway, there it is. Okay. So the first outpouring prepares matter. The second outpouring prepares form. And the third outpouring sort of joins the rising consciousness through refined forms and brings it home, we might say. So this is the symbol of the third and final outpouring. The first outpouring relates to the third aspect, second to the second, and the first, the third outpouring relates to the second aspect. It is the influence of the monad upon the rising, evolving forms. Okay, we'll study these things carefully. I can't vouch for every single thing in these charts. Some of them were put together by the students and I think okayed by DK. All right, let's go on a little. From the cosmic mental plane comes the will to be in time and space. And that might be a little different from the will to be. The will to be might be a much higher thing, but the will to be in time and space. And on what planes do time and space exist? Well, from a certain point of view, they exist on the cosmic physical plane only, but from another point of view, given the rhythmic nature of the great breath, they exist at the very heights of cosmos. It's a difficult thing to solve the relationship between time and duration, and to solve the relationship between the law of periodicity and the law of immutability. Because obviously periodicity is a huge mutation, a regular cyclic mutation, and yet we're dealing with a boundless, immutable principle. So right away at the very top of our considerations and beyond anything we can conceive with great accuracy lie these apparent paradoxes. I have to say apparent because you never know. Maybe to a higher type of mind, the paradox is resolved. So it will be seen then inferentially how the right use of energy by the initiate puts him en rapport not only with the higher planes of the solar system, but also with those cosmic planes whereon our logos has his personality aspect. You know, this is the being Agni, the lower 18 cosmic subplanes, using the word in a symbolic fashion. So, you know, the real Agni is the lower 18 subplanes in relation to the solar logos. You know, his personality, his cosmic concrete mental body, his cosmic astral body, his cosmic physical body, you know, our cosmic physical plane. But, you know, we have some kind of analogy here as well with the planetary logos. because the planetary locus has a causal body which is on plane number 19, if we count from the bottom. And so below the position of that causal body lie 18 cosmic subplanes. And the cosmic subplanes on the cosmic physical plane we normally call our normal planes, you know. But atmic buddhi, manas, all that, atma plane, atmic plane, buddhic plane, monastic plane, they're all subplanes considered cosmically. Okay? So, we can infer the right use of energy, sort of climbing the emanative ladder, puts him en rapport not only with the higher planes of the solar system, you know, monadic, logoic, and so forth, but even into the cosmic planes. And the Christ must have done this, and the Buddha must have done this, because they had the cosmic touch, and somehow they received, they were en rapport with cosmic planes. So let's just say Christ and Buddha did this and were en rapport with the cosmic astral plane and cosmic mental plane, respectively. The right use of physical energy by the initiate gives him the freedom of the cosmic mental plane. Well, okay, you know, we understand that the personality aspect of man is directly related to his dense physical body and his ray. The astral aspect of man is related the soul aspect of man is related to his astral body, and the monadic aspect of man is related to his mental body and its ray. So we're learning how to do here in the following. We are learning how to ascend from low to high, and really quite high. Okay, so the right use of physical energy, I suppose especially etheric, by the initiate gives him the freedom of the cosmic physical plane, and this is the factor of liberative kundalini. The right use of astral energy gives him power on the cosmic astral, and he's just really retracing his emanative descent with an emanative ascent. And the correct use of mental energy, which I guess the Buddha was superb at doing, gives him entrance onto the cosmic mental plane. Yeah. All of these correspondences, of course, G.K. tells us we can wear people out with correspondences, and once the correspondential or the correspondence-making faculty of the disciple is liberated, he can become really tiresome and a real bore. So we've got to be careful about inflicting correspondences upon people for whom they are not so interesting, or maybe for people who are not ready for it. Inferentially then, the three higher centers in man, when functioning perfectly, as I suppose expressions of the three higher monadic types, head, heart, and throat, play their part in this work and of carrying energies from these exalted spheres into the field of activity of the initiate and being doorways into the realms hitherto closed for him. So great is the receptive power of the higher three centers in relation to higher cosmic and systemic souls. sources. So anyway, we're talking about ascending the ladder, descending the ladder, coming and going. We're talking about a great life stream that allows you to descend and rise again. It's really a stream of being, I suppose, but in emanation, there is not really an hiatus anywhere. There may seem to be to the benighted consciousness, and some bridging in consciousness has to be done, but bridging in life is there. So let's just say that while bridging in life is present along the emanative stream, there may be necessities to bridge in consciousness. And that's what we do when we build the Antikarana. Well, we're getting there now, you know, it's late here, and I just don't know if we can, how far we can get here. Okay. No further than this. Each center of chakra is composed of three concentric interplanting whorls or wheels, which in the spiritual man upon the probationary path move slowly in one direction, but gradually quicken their activity as he nears the portal of initiation, but only one direction. And with initiation, the wheel begins to turn on itself, but not yet perhaps in all directions. On initiation, the center of the chakra, a diamond, I guess, a jewel, a point of latent fire is touched, and we might say by the initiator, and the rotation becomes intensified and its activity fourth dimensional, whatever that is going to mean for itself. This is usually described as the wheel turning on itself. It is difficult to express these ideas in words that can be comprehended by the uninitiated. In other words, we have to see. But the effect could be described as a changing from a measured turn to one of a scintillating radiation, a wheel turning upon itself, as the ancient scriptures express it. Well, obviously, I read this long time ago, and those words are implanted in my mind. I'm always shocked to see DK saying the same thing I said a few sentences later, but then who said it first, right? Okay, I learned from him. It is difficult to express the ideas in words, but it might be described more as a from a measured turn, and a measurable turn, I suppose, to one of scintillating radiation, a wheel turning upon itself, as the ancient scriptures express it. Maybe we have the Ouroboros there, the snake swallowing its own tail. Hence, when by purification, conformity to rule, and an aspiration that brooks no hindrance, and that ceases not for pain, the aspirant has caused his centers to pulsate, that's the first ray thing, and to rotate, then and only then can the master lead him into the presence of the Hierophant. And are we talking about the great Hierophant here? Sounds like quite an advanced stage of development. Or are we talking also about the Christ, and are these developments present even before the first initiation? But notice what we have to do. Purification, conformity to rule, and an aspiration which brooks no hindrance. Do we have that? And that ceaseth not for pain. Oh, ouch, I can't keep going. The aspirant has caused his centers to pulsate. That's the first ray thing, and then to rotate. Then and only then can the master lead him into the presence of the Hierophant. The initiator then, with full knowledge of the disciple's ray and of his sub-ray, both egoic and personal, and recognizing any karma that still may cling, touches the center of centers which are in line for vivification, and the hidden fire will then rush up and become focalized. And this is, it looks like control of the Kundalini in the initiation process. Very deep science. If you're really playing with fire, and no mistakes can be allowed on the part of the initiator, whether it be the Christ or the Lord of the world or other initiators that DK mentions in Initiation Humana Sola. Remember always that in the vivification of a center, there is always a corresponding vitalization of the analogous head center till eventually the seven head centers in the body and the seven centers in the head rotate in unison. What a very fascinating piece of information that, you know, we might just not know unless we encountered it and pressed it upon us. Remember always, yeah, that the vivification of a center, in that there is always a corresponding vitalization of the analogous head center, ruled by Vulcan, really, with its very bright and fiery behavior, ruled by Vulcan. And, you know, we sound like we're almost dealing with the, well, the seven head centers, you know, a third initiation. And if we went to Treatise on Cosmic Fire, and we went to page whatever, no, you know, really this should be bigger. It should be at least 150. Okay. And this should be Treatise on Cosmic Fire, and we should be at 170, roughly. And then we see spiritual man at the third initiation, the heart, throat, and seven head centers. So that's what we're talking about here. This process would be at least initially completed at the third initiation. The seven head centers then continue to play their role. They are ruled by Vulcan, just the way Vulcan, as a representative of the Great Bear, rules the seven head centers, in the man, but the Great Bear, as the higher correspondence to Vulcan, rules the seven head centers in the one about whom naught may be said. Remember also that, just as the four minor rays pass into the three major rays, so the four minor centers carry on the correspondence and pass into Brahlaya, finding their focal point in the throat center. Okay, so what are the minor? Well, we know the base of the spine, solar plexus, chakra center, but is the spleen considered, and then the heart center, is it less than or greater than the throat center? So much about it seems to be greater than, but it's got 12 petals only, and the throat center has 16. Thus, you will have the three centers, head, heart, and throat. No, the heart is there, so maybe the spleen is included. Or maybe, I don't know, the Ajna center may be included, carrying the inner fire with the three major head centers vibrating in unison also. Well, okay, he's going to tell us, I'm sorry, I know this is intricate, but we're going to wait till next time for him to do that. Now we have completed this up to page 363. Have I atoned for my sins in that previous half-hour program? I don't know. Haste makes waste, and watch out if you're in Aries, you know, rushing in where angels fear to tread. This is 360, and we finally reach page 363. Okay, so here we go. Yeah. All right, so here we are. So we're ending number 38, and it is a number 22 that ends, and it's a 360 to 363. I kind of left too many things in there earlier. And we're going to start commentary number 39. In this Rules for the Astral Magic, and we'll begin with page 363, and it'll be the 23rd program on this mammoth 10th rule. Ooh, okay. All right, friends, that's going to be it for the moment, and I'll get these things sent out to you as best I can. Study hard, and let's really respect this book. because the kind of information given in a relatively early book, well, look, it was preceded by Cosmic Fire, and there's a huge download there. So, you know, some people look at White Magic, oh, it's one of the preliminary books, you can just read that, but no, this book really is ponderous, a ponderous treatise, as DK says, and it needs to be studied. Okay, on to number 39 when we get a chance. Now it's after midnight, so maybe tonight is not the best time. See you later. Bye-bye. Lots of love. Many blessings. Study hard. Bye.